Giles, which is, brings anti-Semitism, the problem is that, but it's part of it. But I contend the Rockefellers, you go to an anti-Semite, they always say, oh, the reason the Rockefellers got established was because of the Rothschilds, and which is not true. The Rockefellers really, in fact, they seem to have done things the Rothschilds didn't do. Like, they started getting involved with the medical profession, doing all these foundations. And so did the Ford Foundation later on after Henry Ford died. Mm-hmm. And Henry Ford was an anti-Semite who actually had the Protocols of Zion, which was a false document that Jewish people supposedly made. This is kind of shocking. The Model T Ford had it in the McGlove compartment. When you bought a Model T Ford in the teens and 20s, going to, I think, it didn't have a Model T Ford by the end of the 20s, you had a copy of the Protocols of Zion, which was a false document.
Yeah, well, refresh my, what was it? It was something, because they often call it a blood libel, because it's something about, but I can't remember the details.
Well, what I do, I had an opportunity in 1988 to have a look at it, and it just seemed phony to me, and I haven't really bought. Over the years, I have sort of seen a bit on it. It seems to be a false document, and obviously so. But the Illuminati, which began in 1706 in Bavaria. And then it kind of petered itself out by the 1830s for a variety of reasons. And I'm basically going by the Wikipedia entry in this. It was the person that founded it was part of a defunct Jesuit order. The Jesuits still, I think, in fact, the Pope we have now is a Jesuit, they say. Right. But then as it sort of evolved, it got that he was anti-Jesuit, and they tried to get involved with the Freemasons, which still exists, but not to the elaboration that they have. I think the main point is that it existed for a while, and it no longer exists.
Right.
And it was Bavaria and a few other things. I don't know.
what was the purpose of the group? Because we hear, it's something we hear sort of referenced all the time, but in its historical place, what was it about?
Well, I'm just going to read directly from Wikipedia, the first sentences. The Illuminati is a name given to several groups, both real and fictional. Historically, the name refers to the Bavarian Illuminati, an Enlightenment era secret society founded on May 1st, 1776 in Bavaria, which is today part of Germany. The society's stated goals were to oppose superstition. Okay, I don't even. what does O B S C U L R A N T I S M stand for, Magnus? He's looking at my tablet now. Obstructionism.
I think that's it. Yep. Oh.
What does that mean?
It's obscurantism.
Which is pretty obscurism.
Which I think is also around superstition and misinformation and.
Yeah. And ironically, they became part of it. Also, the other thing was that the Rastafarians, they sort of, there was sort of a bit of a conflict with that. The Rastafarians, actually, it's a society that still exists, kind of New Agey before there was the New Age thing. What sort of gets sort of all kind of mixed up? And I talked in a previous show about what on the American $1 bill, you have the all-seeing eye, and how that was actually what the Great Seal of the United States. The other one being more kind of straightforward, the eagle, and the artistic depiction you have was The great, I think it was 1780, they created the Great Seal of the United States. But the artistic rendering is around 1840 that is on, mm-hmm. which wasn't until 1935. It was Franklin Roosevelt's idea.
That's when it was it put placed, on the dollar?
Yeah.
On bills?
Yeah. Yes, okay. But the design is from the 1840s.
Right.
They didn't create a new design. So that is sort of separate from what Illuminati is. But that symbol is seen as being the Illuminati. And the other thing is that... but the Freemasons picked up on that image from it being the Great Seal of the United States, other than the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't an influence of Masonism onto, people think that, the United States picked that as a seal because they were influenced by Masons. The other way around, the Masons yep. liked it, and they just had it. Now, what's interesting also is what presidents were Masons? And the last major president... Actually, the presidents are major, but Gerald Ford was the last president who was a member of the Masons.
Mm-hmm.
Ronald Reagan was made an honorary Freemason, and Bill Clinton was a member of the Masonic Youth Group, Order of the De Morley. So Nixon wasn't a member. Lyndon Johnson was, but they said not that much of a member. And Eisenhower was not a member. So really, going down the list, when almost every president is a Mason, it is Harry Truman's last one. Roosevelt is. But interestingly, Woodrow Wilson,
mm-hmm.
who was president from 1913 to 1921, he was not a Mason. And it's interesting right. that he did the Federal Reserve. Without the symbol, by the way, it wasn't mm-hmm. until 1935 that was on the dollar bill. So, quite a few were, but it doesn't seem to have presently, as far as the presidential powers are,
yeah,
much of an influence right now.
Right.
So, there it is, and it's sort of really. It's interesting, there were actually some black Masons. I don't know if it still exists, but they weren't allowed to be part of the group, and they kind of form.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of has a bit of black American history. Is there a variation of it?
Well, I've read that sort of secret societies, not necessarily nefarious, but secret societies were kind of a thing at Ivy League colleges, certainly in the late 1800s and into the 1900s, something that happened alongside with fraternities and stuff. Of course, fraternities were very public, and I'm not saying they're associated with the fraternities, but it was like this sort of fad or fashion for people joining these secret societies, which carried on for quite a while. I think there was talk that George Bush Sr. was...
That's Skull and Bones. I think that's Skull and Bones you're talking about.
Yeah.
Now, one thing, I'm actually very critical of a film that has been praised since 1978. So I think it's a rather horrendous movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's National Lampoon's and Animal House. you're laughing.
I watched that recently.
You watched it recently. Now, it's interesting that George W. Bush, the son...
Yeah,
there was something I saw some documentary about his life, and he said quite in a serious way, he said, a lot of us, he went to school. It's set in 1962. It came out in 78. He said it kind of, we felt it sort of was what we experienced. No, he didn't say, I really found it a funny movie. He kind of just said it was sort of, it was what we kind of experienced. It kind of echoed it in a sense. Now, what's interesting is that the reason that fraternities started to happen was because around the late 19th century, poorer people were joining universities.
Right.
And the upper crust didn't want to meet them at the local pub or bar. And so they invented their own drinking fraternities of their own that it cost. And it,
and they could limit membership.
Well, the other thing was also that they still exist. In fact, I think National Lampoon's Animal House is sort of a negative film because they were dying down, and now they, after that, today we want Animal House. I mean, why you want Animal House? Okay, you want Animal House.
A sort of unintended consequence.
Well, actually, there are there's a podcast about, there's a, in, I don't know what, southern United States, state has a fraternity, and they sort of have the Confederate flag part of it or something. Yep. And somebody was in trouble for getting Prozac or something. I mean, it was sort of, it was quite serious. He went to jail or something. So actually, that's another separate thing. They may want to, don't they go towards Greek life? Because it's like, I know, what's the one in Animal House? They're, because but they do the Roman thing. It's alpha, beta, or something.
Well, yeah, and it celebrated, popularized the toga party and all that kind of stuff. But yeah,
but the very names echo Greek.
Yeah, well,
Greek,
they're all, you know, they have letters, Greek letters, in their names, like, you know, alpha, beta, kappa, or things like that. You know, so they're. Their names are made from Greek letters, from
are
the Greek
we,
alphabet.
I mean, I'm a non-student here at SFU, but is Simon Fraser free of these fraternities?
They are not. There are some fraternities that are sort of active, but they're not officially recognized by anybody. So they're not officially recognized by the university nor by the student society. You know, so they might exist as a sort of, and I'm not even sure they're official, as a sort of student club, but that's about it. So there's a lot of opposition to them here for, I think, a number of reasons. The elitism of them, which is, you know, goes back to what you're talking about, their origins as a way of, you know, allowing, you know, the wealthy and elite students to separate themselves and sort of maintain exclusivity, you know, from more middle class or ordinary students. Probably middle class isn't really the term for 18th century students, but or 19th century students. But also, you know, the drinking culture that has grown up around them, which is a whole another story, of, you know, the problematic culture around that and some of the really horrific things that sometimes happen from that. I read an article a few years ago, I think it was in The Atlantic, that went into that quite extensively, and how, like, often when a fraternity chapter gets into trouble because of some crazy incident, often related to alcohol, they're frequently, you know, cut loose by the national organization to, you know, protect the national organization from liability. Lots of problems with, you know, I mean, I suppose for some folks they're fun, but... there's lots of, you know, there's definitely students here trying to get that kind of thing going, and there's other students who are really opposed and don't want to see them established.
All right.
So the Illuminati. What are you going to talk about for next week?
Next week, which is going to be a few minutes away here in the studio.
You're not supposed to break the illusion.
Let the people know the big secrets here.
Okay.
David Orchard,
okay,
who was critical of NAFTA. And that's going to be a week away.
All right.
You listeners in Radioland.
Thanks, Peter. Peter R.H. And back to our regular program here at Speak Up.
I'm Madeline Taylor. You're listening to a documentary produced for CJSF 90.1 FM's Making Time for Radio project. This is I Am a Fruit Tree.
This is my island in the sun, where my people have toiled since time begun. I may sail on many a sea, her shores will always be home to me.
Simon Fraser University has a bit of a reputation. It's known to be dark, the architecture is often compared to a prison, and everyone complains about the commute. Because we all commute, it's hard to make friends on the mountain. As a student, it's easy to let this stereotype dictate your experience. We fall into the tyranny of the urgent. It's tempting to plug in, power through, and ignore the world around you. Thankfully, there are characters at SFU who break this mold every day.
I'm Shiraz Ramji. I was born in Tanzania, East Africa, on 10th December 1948. At present, I'm 66 years old. That is about 24,000 days, because I love to count my age in days, and I can celebrate my birthday every day. I'm an educator. I'm trained as a teacher and also as a gerontologist, and I call myself a justice-friendly pacifist.
Shiraz is very well known at SFU for a few different reasons. He has lectured, worked, and studied all over campus since 1994. I first met Shiraz when I was a student. He was standing in a main concourse with a smile, giving out copies of his poetry. He wears sports clothes emblazoned with SFU logos and walks like he's late for something. What is striking about him is his lack of pretense. He doesn't expect anything from you when he offers his poetry. It's simply an open invitation to engage. I found this so unusual and couldn't quite figure out what his motivation was. As it turns out, Shiraz is a peace activist. He told me he's been writing poetry since he was a young boy. He calls it part of his activism and uses poetry to start conversations and spread his message of justice-friendly peace.
It was mostly grade 5 or 6 somewhere where the teacher said, "You speak like a poet." I didn't know what he meant, but he says, write whatever you're speaking. And he would read it and he said, "This is poetry and you should write it all the time." One day I realized the price of photocopy at my student union was 4 cents. So I said, "Oh, I can afford that." So I said, "Okay, I'll spend $2 every day for my poetry." So I started printing them. And then I started sharing them. That was about 12 years ago.
Shiraz doesn't only do this at SFU. He approaches people in every part of his daily life.
That's always a challenge, whom I should ask. But sometimes it can be like this morning. There was a woman on the SkyTrain. She was reading about elementary educators. So I said, I am an educator. So I asked her, "Do you read poetry and where do you study?" And I said, "I write poetry." So I gave her one. So it depends. If I know, like SFU students, is very easy. So I just tell them, "I write poetry. Do you read poetry?" And then they say yes. So I said, "Take one." And if they don't want it, then I say, "Thank you. Okay, next." But even if I didn't have poetry, I would just talk to people. So that has always been my lifestyle.
Back at SFU, Shiraz took me around to some of his favorite parts of campus. On this little walking tour, I discovered that homemade hummus is another tool he uses to connect.
Hi, here she is. Hi, Sarah. How are you?
Hello, Shiraz.
How are you?
I'm doing very well.
Yeah.
To see you.
Nice. I'm thinking of your ice cream all the time.
I love it.
So my name is Sarah Manassian, and I'm the fitness programmer at SFU Recreation. When I think of Shiraz, I just think of this warm, smiling guy. He would come into the fitness center, and he'd always bring us pita and homemade hummus. And it was staffs like would get excited about, like, "Oh, it's Sunday, Shiraz is coming in, he's gonna bring his like pita and homemade hummus," and we just loved that. That's probably one of my fondest memories, because it would happen every weekend, like without stop. And I think that kind of made our fitness center more of a community too, because people would actually come in on the weekends because they knew Shiraz was going to come to bring pita and hummus, and they come in on the weekends, so we'd all sit around and eat the hummus that Shiraz would bring.
He got this reaction constantly. What I wanted to know was what in his life led Shiraz to be so open with his community. After getting to know him better, I started to understand the root of his activism.
Well, you see, when I grew up in Tanzania, I was born in 1948, so I started schooling in 1954. And so it was still part of British colony, and So you see all the racism and segregation of all the different racial groups and so on. So you knew what was colonialism, what is dictatorship, and you hear about all the wars and stuff like that. There were schools which were for European settlers, and then there were Asian schools, and there were African schools. Yeah, like even the buses, they had segregated place. You had to, like you got the movies, you had to stand up because you had to sing the God Save the King and stuff like that. So we all knew that, and the whole glorification of Britain, how good it is. And it was legally that way, but it... So some people assimilated with the whole thing and accepted their second-class status. I wasn't very keen on that, so it was there all the time.
Tanzania achieved independence from British colonial rule in 1961. To the south, Mozambique was under Portuguese colonial rule. They endured a decade of anti-colonial struggle, followed by a civil war through the 1970s and 80s. In the 1970s, Shiraz taught in Tanzania. There, he supported the African Liberation Movement and its activists.
It was part of the anti-colonial struggle in Tanzania itself. We were quite influenced by Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Angela Davis. So it was at a global level as well as local level, there was the whole issue of anti-apartheid.
These experiences of colonial violence, segregation, and oppression have made Shiraz very aware of the dangers of focusing on difference.
I mean, I met a lot of the present and the past leaders of South Africa or Mozambique and so on. So they would come to our school and give a talk. So it has been very much part of my struggle, yeah.
By the early 1990s, after decades of working in education, in medical research, in public health, and in refugee advocacy in East Africa, Shiraz was looking for a change. Both of his parents had passed away, and his partner was killed in a bicycle accident while studying in London.
Well, I was in Africa at that time, and she was finishing her master's in nutrition. And that's when it happened. So we were studying together at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. So I got the news from family and so on of that happened, because she was going to join me. So that was quite tragic. But then I didn't know what to tell people because I moved from Tanzania to Zimbabwe. So they didn't know her, right? So it was very hard to tell people. So that was on time when I was on my own. At that level, I'm more of a private person. Like, I wouldn't talk much about these things, generally, unless people ask me. So when it came to 94, my mission was at least to be involved with anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, and then independence came in April 94. Mother had passed, my father had also passed in Africa. After the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa was become more independent struggles, right, I wanted a break. And my sister was very ill, so I came to Canada.
Shiraz's transition to Canada was eased by his entry into community life at SFU. A student and an educator for his whole life, he was comfortable at school.
So here is our library. So this is what I call the holy place, the holy land, SFU holy land. It's for everybody.
Shiraz talks a lot about globalizing friendship and how this can be done through sharing food with your community. Food was a central theme in all of the conversations I had with Shiraz. This is Celeste. She taught Shiraz when he took a movement class at SFU.
There was an unforgettable story. Every student in the class is required to teach the rest of the class a dance. It could be a circle dance, a folk dance, but they have to make it up from scratch. Shiraz taught us a dance called the Hummus Dance. It was like a group dance around food globalization, and we danced the hummus. We made the hummus through dance. The joy that he brought to this piece and the love that he brought to this piece was so truly moving.
Shiraz doesn't believe in the idea of strangers. He thinks it allows for fear and separation.
Because I don't have many family members, so I just interact with people as if they are part of the family. Mm-hmm. So when I'm going in the morning exercise, I'm feeling I'm with the community. And so it's a way to break the barrier of being lonely or isolated.
To be honest, I don't know what the words are for it. I feel a feeling when I think of Shiraz. I think maybe the thing that's different about him is he'll engage anybody and everybody. He's just so welcoming. He's so open. He'll come up, he'll give you a hug, he'll speak smiles. Have you read my poetry lately? Here's what's going on. Do you want some hummus? I'm going to bring you some food. Like, it's every time that you see him.
As I said, I always want to know, first to create that community and make people not be afraid of me or anybody else. But also to hear stories of people in terms of not necessarily private stories, but how do they look at life and how do they respond to people like me. So it gives me a feeling that there are many people who want to create that community, but somebody has to start. Almost every case, I'm the one who starts, and then the ball starts rolling.
I love the sense of his deep curiosity for life. To me, that's what SFU was all about. Now I look around at SFU and I see them all. They look absolutely, everyone looks bored to death. You get Shiraz walking through here. He just has a love of life. And you know, it doesn't even need a cell phone.
So it turns out that Shiraz isn't well known at SFU because of his longevity. It's because he reminds people of what they really want from campus. Community and a sense of belonging.
SFU is a happy place, and it's also a place with some challenges. Happiness in a sense, there's a diversity of people. It can be sadness because the education system, so a lot of education is very Eurocentric. And there are a lot of slogans like critical learning or critical thinking, but essentially it's more conformist education. So it can be challenging for you. I normally consider every person is a fruit tree, so I said just enjoy the fruit.
Why a fruit tree?
Well, I was surrounded. I grew up with so many fruit trees. Papayas grow in 9 months. I used to plant a lot of fruit trees. And I think it's a universal food. There's no recipe for fruit trees. It's just fruit. So I thought as a global citizen, it fits in my narrative.
What does community mean to you?
Community is like what I call the fruit salad, right? Where you have a mixture of everybody around. So it's much of a collective experience. I mean, there are collective experience in SFU, for example. It's a community, right?
His outlook is contagious. But here's the thing. What is a community? A community is a group of people with something in common, but it's often described as a sense. You feel a sense of community. It's not something that geographic locations just have on their own. Shiraz's approach is to make every space into a community.
I believe we all have the capacity to touch into something that is invisible, that is greater than us, on however you articulate it. But it is a love that infuses far beyond the imagination and far beyond our daily living, because our daily living is fraught with so many difficulties. And I think Shiraz has probably had experiences enough to have to empty himself, where he then is tapped into this greater source of love. And I'm not going to articulate certain labels around that, but I believe he embodies love.
I tell people, I believe that I'm not the only Shiraz in the world. There are many people in Shiraz in the world. And, for example, I can relate to you because I see Shiraz in you and you see yourself in me, right? So don't assume you're alone.
His poetry is not only in print, it's the impression he leaves on people. His embodiment of the fruit tree allows him to connect and create openness and curiosity in the people he meets. He makes eye contact, simple conversation, and impacts SFU by building community through the simple act of constant and unapologetic engagement.
That's what I tell people. Take your path. If you need help, come and have a tea with me.
Well, on that note, can you share a poem or two with us?
Yeah, okay. I'll share with you the one, my favorite one, which is my autobiography of as a child. It's called "We Are Mother Earth." I am a fruit tree. I am a fruitful tree. I am a banana tree. I grow bananas shaped like human lips to share and tell stories with my global friends. I am a cherry tree. I grow cherries shaped like human eyes.
This documentary was produced with the support and assistance of CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I would also like to thank Shiraz Ramji, Celeste Snober, Sarah Manassian, and Victoria Haraway for their voices and stories.
her shores will always be home to me. Oh, island.